She left that house and was never seen alive again. Her screams were heard. Her fear was known. But nothing stopped him. Kevin Ware Jr. was an ex-NFL player, a violent offender, and somehow a free man. Until she vanished. This is not just a story of murder. It's a story of manipulation, of a man who silenced a woman and a system that helped him do it. My name is Gideon Ross, and this is the investigation they hoped you'd forget. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. She vanished after the party. I remember the heat. It was late April in Texas, one of those sticky, windless nights where the air itself seems to hold its breath, the kind of night where something bad feels inevitable. Spring, Texas, a quiet suburb just north of Houston. Street after street of clean lawns, two-story homes, flags on porches. But here at the end of a cul-de-sac, something happened that would change everything. This was where Taylor Pomaski, 29 years old, was last seen, April 25th, 2021, at a house party hosted at her home. A night that started with music, laughter, and drinks, and ended with her disappearance. I stood outside that house 2 years later, mailbox rusted, curtains drawn, stillness like a warning. I knocked, no one answered. The neighbors wouldn't talk much either, but the police report said it clearly. Multiple witnesses at the party saw an argument, loud, heated, physical. Some claimed Taylor and her boyfriend, Kevin Ware Jr., were screaming. Some heard her cry. Others said they saw her shoved. What's certain is that after that night, Taylor was never seen alive again. No one called 911. No one filed a missing persons report. And where? He told conflicting stories. First, he said she walked away. Then he wasn't sure. Then he clammed up entirely. That's when I knew I wasn't chasing a story. I was chasing something much heavier, the unraveling of a woman's life and the manipulation that allowed it to be erased. Let's talk about Kevin Ware Jr. On the surface, he was a former NFL tight end, played for the Washington Redskins and the San Francisco 49ers. Not a superstar, but he'd made it to the league. That gave him a kind of shield. People still called him Kev like they knew him, but beneath that image was a very different man. Because just 5 days before Taylor vanished, Ware had been arrested in Montgomery County, speeding 115 miles per hour, swerving between lanes. Deputies pulled him over and found an AK-47, a 9mm pistol, cocaine, methamphetamine, marijuana, and a digital scale, all while he was on bond from previous charges. And somehow, he was released again. Let me say that again for the record. Kevin Ware Jr. was released on bond with an arsenal and hard drugs in his car. And 5 days later, the woman closest to him disappeared without a trace. It raises a question that's hard to ignore. Was Ware playing the system, or was the system playing itself? I requested interviews, friends, neighbors. I sat in diners, called numbers that had long gone cold. Most didn't want to talk, well, not on the record. One woman, a neighbor who asked not to be named, told me quietly, I heard her yelling for help once, maybe 2 weeks before, then nothing. That line stuck with me, then nothing. It wasn't just Taylor who vanished, so did the urgency. It was weeks before authorities took any real action. The sheriff's office didn't treat her disappearance as suspicious at first. No Amber Alert, no missing person bulletin with urgency. It was treated like a domestic squabble. Maybe she left. Maybe she was staying with friends. That's what Ware claimed. But Taylor's family never believed that. Her friends didn't either. She left behind her dog. Her phone went silent. Her social media, once active, filled with laughter and selfies, went dark, and Kevin Ware stayed quiet. I pulled her last text messages. Some were light, about the party, others darker. She wrote to a friend, "I need to get out before it gets worse. He's not who I thought." That was April 23rd, 2 days before the party, 2 days before everything fell off the map. When I retraced her final hours, I wasn't just following a timeline. I was walking through layers of emotional erosion. Taylor had tried to hold on, to make it work. She'd been in love. But by April, the messages changed. They became desperate, unstable. Her mind was racing, trying to find an escape plan, but Kevin had already gotten too close, too deep. This wasn't a random act of violence. This was a slow boil, the kind of manipulation that operates in the shadows, a mix of charm, control, gaslighting, and quiet threats. Taylor didn't just disappear. She was systematically isolated, emotionally worn down, until the silence finally swallowed her whole. I end this chapter here, with a photo. Taylor Pomaski, brown hair, honest smile, eyes with light in them. Posted to Instagram just weeks before she disappeared. The caption, "I've been quiet, but I'm still here." That's the part that breaks me, because not long after that, she wasn't. And Kevin Ware? He was just getting started. The NFL player with a dark record. You don't make it to the NFL without some degree of discipline. At least that's what people like to believe. But when I started digging into Kevin Ware Jr.'s background, I didn't find a story of discipline. I found a pattern of manipulation, aggression, and legal leniency that reads more like a how-to manual on slipping through the cracks. Let's go back. Kevin Ware Jr. grew up in Texas, played college football at the University of Washington, signed briefly with the Washington Redskins in 2003, then the San Francisco 49ers. He bounced around. He never became a star, but he had the frame, the resume, and the name. In communities like Spring, that's enough to carry weight. People remember your jersey more than your record, but the record is what matters now. His first known run-ins with the law, dating back to the mid-2000s. Assault, evading arrest, unlawful possession of controlled substances. None of it made national news. He wasn't famous enough, but the charges accumulated like rust on a trophy. Minor to some, repetitive to anyone paying attention. Then came December 2018. Kevin was convicted of intent to manufacture or deliver a controlled substance in Montgomery County. He got probation. That probation should have been a line in the sand. Instead, it was just another blurred boundary. Fast forward to April 19th, 2021, just 6 days before Taylor Pomaski disappeared. Kevin Ware is pulled over for speeding at 115 miles per hour on Interstate 45 in Harris County. The traffic stop becomes something far more serious. Inside his Dodge Challenger, deputies find an AK-47, a 9mm pistol, a digital scale, cocaine, methamphetamine, marijuana, and Xanax. Let me be clear, this wasn't personal use. It was distribution weight, it was arsenal-level firepower. And Ware was a felon, meaning it was illegal for him to possess any firearms at all. You'd think that would be enough to put someone in jail indefinitely. But Kevin was released on bond. And within 5 days, Taylor Pomaski would be gone. I still can't get over that detail. The system knew what he had in his car. It knew he was a convicted felon. It knew he was on probation. And it let him out, back into the home of a woman he'd been accused of abusing. This isn't just legal error. It's legal negligence. I requested court transcripts, police incident reports, probation memos. I wanted to know, did anyone ever flag Kevin Ware as a threat? Was there a pattern? A warning? The answer, quietly, yes. There were several calls to police about disturbances at the Spring, Texas home where he lived with Taylor. At least one incident report noted visible injuries, but no formal charges. Taylor never pressed them. That's how manipulation works. It's not always loud. It's not always bruises. Sometimes it's quiet threats, isolation, control of the narrative. One friend told me, off the record, that Ware wouldn't let Taylor leave the house without his permission, that he checked her phone, that she had become someone else. When I asked if she ever considered calling the police, the friend paused and said she didn't want to die. That line haunted me. Ware knew how to control his surroundings. That's what makes predators like him effective. He used silence as leverage, legal gray areas as cover, and his NFL past as a shield. In spring, people still called him NFL Kev. That came with a twisted kind of respect. But behind the headlines, there was nothing respectable about the way Kevin Ware lived. He was manipulative. He was calculated. And by the time Taylor tried to break free, it was already too late. I visited the Montgomery County Jail after his arrest in 2021. I requested an interview. He declined. But I watched him through the glass. He didn't look angry or scared. He looked bored, like the process was familiar, like he'd done this before. Maybe not murder, not yet, but the performance, the courtroom nods, the quiet compliance, the confident smirk. This is a man who knew how to navigate the legal system, not because he respected it, but because he knew how to manipulate it. Just like he manipulated Taylor, I keep thinking back to that bond hearing. How does a man with a previous felony conviction, found in possession of narcotics and two guns, get bond, then walk free days before his girlfriend disappears? One prosecutor told me, honestly, the system is overworked. Cases get pushed. And sometimes, dangerous people fall through the cracks. That's the polite version, the real version. Ware didn't fall through the cracks. He crawled through them, and no one stopped him. By the time Taylor vanished, Kevin Ware was already a walking red flag. But flags don't matter when the people holding them look away. He was out on bond, armed, dangerous. And she was alone in that house. That's not a coincidence. That's cause and effect. What the ex-boyfriend knew. There's a text that's hard to forget. It was sent by Taylor Pamaski just days before she vanished. Short, uneasy, a warning in plain sight. I need to get out before it gets worse. He's not who I thought. I found that message buried in a thread between Taylor and an ex-boyfriend she'd stayed friendly with. His name isn't public, and at his request, I'll keep it that way. But when I spoke to him, face to face, what struck me wasn't his anger. It was the guilt. We met in a small coffee shop off Interstate 45, about 30 minutes from Spring. He came in wearing sunglasses, even though it was cloudy, and he kept fidgeting with his sleeve. The first thing he said was, "I should have gone over there." That line settled between us like a verdict neither of us could undo. According to him, Taylor had started reaching out more frequently in March and April of 2021. The messages were short, unsteady, as if she was afraid of being watched. She never explicitly said she was being abused, but the subtext was unmistakable. "He doesn't like when I talk to people. He always checks my phone. I'm not allowed to leave the house without telling him." It's the pattern anyone trained in behavioral psychology or domestic violence response recognizes immediately. Isolation, surveillance, control, classic emotional manipulation tactics. The kind that don't always leave bruises, but always leave scars. She told him she wanted to leave, but she was scared. And here's the part that crushed me. She asked if he could help her move out. "Maybe sometime next week." She never made it to next week. By all accounts, Taylor was trying to escape, but Ware was skilled at keeping her tethered, not with kindness, but with volatility. He flipped between charm and threat, apology and intimidation. What we're talking about here is a classic manipulative personality, someone who erodes your confidence, then positions himself as your only safe place. It's not random violence. It's calculated emotional engineering. She had told friends that he was tracking her movements. She'd started using Instagram DMs instead of text because "he goes through my phone when I sleep." She said he accused her of cheating, called her names, threatened to end her life if she ever left him. words she apparently repeated to more than one friend, though no one filed a report. No one called the police. Why? Because she asked them not to. Because, like many victims, she thought protecting him was the only way to protect herself. I went back through Taylor's social media. The early months with Ware looked like every other new relationship. Smiles, selfies, weekend trips. But by January 2021, her posts started slowing. By March, they stopped completely. Her last public post was a selfie with a sunset behind her. The caption read, "I'm still here." A few weeks later, she was gone. The ex-boyfriend also told me about a call Taylor made on April 23rd, 2 days before she vanished. It was late. He said she sounded out of breath, nervous, paranoid. She told him she had packed a bag, that she was thinking of leaving while Ware was out running errands. But she never followed through. She said, "What if he finds me?" And then she hung up. That was the last time he heard her voice. It's hard to quantify how many women are lost, not just to violence, but to the manipulation that precedes it. Taylor's story isn't unique. That's what makes it so terrifying. According to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, 1 in 4 women experiences severe intimate partner violence, and many, like Taylor, never make it out. Why? Because they're isolated. Because their abuser is charming in public. Because they're conditioned to doubt their own instincts. And sometimes, because the people who could have helped weren't sure if they were allowed to. There's another piece I need to include here. Not speculation, just fact. After Taylor's disappearance, Ware never helped search for her, never printed flyers, never called her friends, never posted a plea, not one word on social media, not one visit to police, not even a call to report her missing. It was her family, and eventually the media, who forced the case into public view. Ware stayed quiet, detached, emotionless. I went back to that coffee shop a week after the interview, just to sit in that space again, to remember her voice through someone else's guilt. The ex-boyfriend never called me back, but I didn't need him to. Taylor had already told us everything, in her own words. We just didn't listen fast enough. A body in the ditch. It was a cold December morning in 2021 when the call came in. Human remains had been found in a ditch off a remote stretch of road in northern Harris County, Texas. The kind of place people drive past without looking. A place where the grass grows wild and no one asks questions. It had been nearly 8 months since Taylor Pomaski vanished after that house party. 8 months of silence, rumors, tips that led nowhere. Her name was still floating in forums, barely making the evening news anymore. Even the initial urgency had faded, swallowed by other headlines, other tragedies. But this changed everything. I drove out there myself, just hours after the remains were found. The site was taped off. Officers stood around in thick coats, faces blank, focused. A few crime scene techs were bent over the edge of the ditch, brushing soil, collecting samples. There was no body visible anymore. Only a shallow depression in the earth, discolored by ash, scorched black like someone had tried to erase something permanent. That's when I knew. This wasn't a dumping. This was a burial by someone who needed her to disappear. Forensics moved quickly, faster than usual. They needed to determine identity, cause of death, and if there were signs of a cover-up. But deep down, we all knew what they'd find. And sure enough, by April 2022, the remains were positively identified as Taylor Pomaski. Dental records, DNA, all matched. The woman who had been reported missing, barely, had finally been found, but only pieces of her. According to court documents I reviewed, her body had been burned. There were signs of trauma consistent with blunt force injuries, sharp force wounds, and possible strangulation. The details were grisly. The kind you can't say out loud without feeling like you're disrespecting the dead. But they matter, because this wasn't just a murder. It was a message, a cover-up attempt, and possibly a delay tactic. You don't burn a body unless you want to destroy the evidence. You don't bury it in a ditch unless you want time. And for nearly a year, Kevin Ware Jr. had exactly that. I went back to the scene again, weeks after the investigation moved on. No more tape, no officers, just a faint scar in the landscape. And a cross. Someone had left one. White plastic. Simple. Taylor's name was written on it in permanent marker. There were flowers too. Dead. The wind was high that day. You could hear it move through the trees like a whisper. That's where I stood when the question started hitting me harder than before. Did she die that night, April 25th, in that house? Was it planned? An argument gone too far? Or was it premeditated? A trap she didn't see coming? I wasn't speculating, I was following the methodology, the patterns that experts in criminal behavior recognize. Multiple sources familiar with the case confirmed that Taylor's injuries were consistent with sustained violence, not a single moment of rage. The burning of her body wasn't hasty. It was methodical. It was calculated. Let's be clear, Ware wasn't charged at this point. Not yet. For months after the remains were found, he remained in custody. Not for Taylor, but for violating the terms of his bond. He'd been arrested again in June 2021 on federal weapons charges. That's where they kept him. But not one official word about murder. Behind the scenes, though, the puzzle was coming together. Investigators were building a timeline. Kevin Ware, the last person to see her alive. Kevin Ware, whose history of violence was buried under legal documents. Kevin Ware, whose silence was louder than any confession. And here's the part that made it all feel even colder. He never asked about the remains. Never requested a DNA test. Never reached out to her family. There was no grief, no denial, no curiosity, nothing. That, to me, was the most chilling evidence of all, because even killers sometimes pretend to care. But Ware? He acted like she'd never existed. I spoke with a forensic anthropologist who had consulted informally on the case. She didn't give me details protected by law, but she said something that stayed with me. When a person tries to destroy a body, they're not just destroying the evidence, they're trying to erase a story, erase context, erase accountability. That's what happened to Taylor. She wasn't just killed, she was silenced. And her killer assumed no one would ever find her. But we did. And the story, her story, started speaking for itself. Manipulation in the courtroom. The first time I saw Kevin Ware Jr. in a courtroom, he didn't look like a man who had just been accused of murder. No handcuffs, no panic, just a stiff suit, emotionless eyes, and the kind of silence that wasn't weakness. It was strategy. By the time he sat across from the prosecution in July 2022, the system had already carried him further than it should have. He was officially charged with two things, murder and tampering with evidence involving a human corpse. But even those words felt sterile next to what had really happened. I sat three rows back. To my left, Taylor Pomaski's parents, staring straight ahead. No visible emotion, just tension, like their muscles hadn't unclenched since the moment they learned their daughter had been found in a ditch, burned and barely identifiable. To my right, a reporter from a local paper, scribbling half-heartedly like this was just another Thursday in Harris County. But for me, this wasn't just a hearing. This was a lesson in courtroom manipulation. Let's start with the delay. Kevin Ware wasn't indicted until 15 months after Taylor vanished and nearly 7 months after her body was discovered. Why? Because building a murder case is hard, but building a murder case against someone who's already in custody, silent, calm, not confessing, that's harder. And Ware? He gave them nothing. No statements, no mistakes, just smug compliance, like he was playing a long game. Every legal analyst I spoke to said the same thing. He's stalling, waiting for the case to weaken, hoping evidence deteriorates, witnesses disappear, public interest fades. And for a while, that strategy worked. The court records reveal the timeline. June 2021. Ware arrested on federal gun charges. Not Taylor's case. December 2021. Taylor's remains found. April 2022. Her identity confirmed. July 2022. Ware finally indicted for murder and corpse tampering. Even then, there was no trial date. Just motion after motion, legal tactics, postponements. I spoke to a defense attorney not involved with the case. He told me flatly, Ware had good counsel. They knew the longer they dragged this out, the less pressure there would be to go to trial. And if they could negotiate a plea, even better. And that's exactly what happened. May 7th, 2025. Kevin Ware Jr. pleaded guilty to murder and tampering with a human corpse. No jury, no cross-examinations, no testimonies from Taylor's family or friends, no reading of her final messages, no photographic evidence of what her body looked like when they pulled it from the ditch. Just a signature on a plea deal and a 30-year sentence handed down quietly in a courtroom where almost no one was watching anymore. Now let's be real. A 30-year sentence in Texas is not light. He will be eligible for parole only after serving half, and even then, there are no guarantees. But it also means he avoided life without parole. It means he didn't have to face a public trial. It means the full scope of what he did to Taylor never had to be laid bare in front of a jury. He skipped that reckoning, and in doing so, he controlled the outcome, just like he controlled everything else. I sat in the gallery that day, watching him stand for sentencing. He didn't speak, didn't apologize, didn't look at Taylor's family. The judge asked him if he understood the terms of the plea agreement. He nodded, and that was it. 30 years. Signed. Stamped. Done. Afterward, I stepped outside the courthouse. The sky was overcast. The press was minimal. Two cameras, one radio guy. No swarming crowd, no national spotlight. Just a slow fade into obscurity. A few minutes later, Taylor's mother stepped out. She was holding a folded piece of paper. She didn't read it aloud. She just told me softly. I wrote a statement for the court. They didn't let me read it. Plea deal made it unnecessary. That word, unnecessary, stuck with me because nothing about Taylor's story was unnecessary. But Ware made sure her voice was excluded from the official record. And that, in my view, is the final manipulation. Not the murder, not the burning of her body, but the quiet burial of the truth inside a plea deal. Ware didn't just kill Taylor. He erased the part where the world had to listen to her scream. The woman they tried to erase. Let me tell you who Taylor Pomaski really was, because after everything she endured, the silence, the violence, the manipulation, the headlines that reduced her to missing woman or Ware's girlfriend, it's easy to forget she had a life before any of this, a full, complicated, human life. And that's exactly what Kevin Ware tried to erase. She was born in 1992, raised in the suburbs of Houston, went to college, worked in tech and events. She loved concerts, had a goofy sense of humor, and, by all accounts, a big heart for people who didn't always deserve it. Her Instagram shows snapshots of sunsets, dogs, friends, candles, and comfort food. Her captions were light but personal, reflective. You could tell she was someone who loved hard, even when things got complicated. Maybe especially then. She wasn't naive. She was hopeful, and there's a difference. When I interviewed one of her closest friends, she told me something that stuck like a knife. She was always trying to fix broken people. She saw pain in people and wanted to heal it. That's what she thought she could do with Kevin Ware. They met at a party in late 2020. He was charming, magnetic, familiar. She liked that he was older, stable seeming, a man with a past, but, in her mind, maybe trying to change. By January 2021, they were living together. By March, she was telling friends she felt trapped. She had started shrinking. Her social life faded. Her posts stopped. The bright colors in her wardrobe dimmed into neutrals. She stopped going out as much. Friends were told she was just tired or going through a lot. But really, she was being manipulated, emotionally exhausted, broken down. This wasn't just physical abuse. This was systematic emotional control, the kind of dark psychology that thrives behind closed doors. He isolated her from her friends, monitored her phone, controlled her finances, and threatened violence if she ever left. Kevin Ware didn't just abuse her. He rewrote her reality until she barely recognized herself. And still, she tried to escape. That's the part we can't forget. She told multiple people she was planning to leave. She asked her ex for help. She packed a bag. She made mental lists of where to go, how to get there, when to do it. But the moment never came, because victims of this kind of control don't get clean exits. They get ambushed. And that's what happened to Taylor. After her body was found, some reporters used the term remains like it was technical, clean. But I've seen the evidence logs, the autopsy files. What was done to her wasn't clean. It was violent, personal, cruel. He tried to burn her, to scatter her, to bury her in a ditch, as if erasing the body could erase the person. But it didn't, because Taylor wasn't just a victim. She was a daughter, a friend, a human being with a future she was fighting for, even in her final days. I asked her mother once what she would say to people who only remember Taylor through the lens of Kevin Ware's crime. She didn't hesitate. I would tell them my daughter was not weak. She was trying to survive. She was trying to get out. And she deserved more time to do that. That's the tragedy buried beneath this case. The idea of who Taylor might have become if the people around her had listened sooner, if the justice system had moved faster, if Ware hadn't been released on bond, if friends hadn't been afraid to intervene, if just one thing had gone differently. But here's the truth. Taylor fought. She reached out. She saw the red flags. She tried to escape. And that makes her stronger than most people realize. You can try to erase a woman like that, but the silence doesn't last forever. The truth always finds its way back. And when it does, it speaks louder than the man who tried to silence her. A system that let her die. Let's strip this story down to what it really is. Taylor Pomaski didn't just die because of Kevin Ware Jr. She died because we let her, not you and me personally, but all of us, the system we've built, the red flags we've normalized, the loopholes we ignore, because everything that should have protected her failed her. And that's where the story really ends. Kevin Ware had a criminal record dating back over a decade. Assaults, drug charges, weapons, probation violations. In 2018, he was convicted of intent to distribute a controlled substance. He received probation. Then in April 2021, just 5 days before Taylor vanished, Ware was pulled over doing 115 miles per hour. He had an AK-47, a 9mm pistol, meth, cocaine, marijuana, Xanax, and a digital scale. And what did the system do? Released him on bond. Let that sink in. A felon, caught with an arsenal and distribution-level drugs, on active probation. And he walked, straight back into the home of the woman he was slowly destroying. We can't keep calling this falling through the cracks. This wasn't a crack. This was a chasm, and everyone just looked the other way. The bond system didn't stop him. Probation officers didn't stop him. The police, who responded to multiple domestic disturbance calls at Taylor's house and filed no formal charges, didn't stop him. Even after Taylor went missing, it took 8 months to find her body and another year to charge him with murder. And when the time came to prosecute, they offered a plea deal. Now, I understand the logic. Prosecutors didn't want to risk a trial. The evidence was partial. The remains were burned. The case was circumstantial, albeit strong. But here's the problem with plea deals in cases like this. The public never hears the full story. The photos aren't shown. The texts aren't read aloud. The friends and family never testify. The violence becomes quietly negotiated instead of openly condemned. Ware didn't have to face a jury of Taylor's peers. He didn't have to listen to her mother's statement. He didn't have to hear the word monster in open court. Instead, he stood for sentencing like he'd beaten the system, because in some ways, he had. When I think about manipulation, not just in personal relationships, but in society, I think about how easy it is for predators to weaponize loopholes. Where was the perfect manipulator? He knew how to present himself in court, calm, quiet, cooperative. He knew when to go silent, he knew when to make noise, and he knew that most people, when presented with just enough doubt, would do nothing. He played the emotional system, the legal system, and the social system like a man who'd done it before. But here's what he didn't expect, that we'd still be talking about her, that Taylor Pomaski wouldn't be reduced to a headline or a cold case file, that people like you would still be listening, because remembering her story is the one thing he can't control. I close this chapter and this investigation with a hard truth. Ware may have killed Taylor, but the system built the cage she died in. And until that changes, she won't be the last